So today I want to pick up a couple of threads that Aria and Sayadaw and I have been talking about and continue. Today, talking explicitly about what one of the things in particular that metta purifies and the importance of right effort. Opening with a verse from the Dhammapada. Cultivate the wholesome. Refrain from the unwholesome. Purify the mind. This is the teaching of all of the Buddhas. It's so simple. Cultivating the wholesome. Refraining from the unwholesome. Purifying the mind. And the unwholesome in this case are what is called the three unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the wholesome specifically are the three wholesome roots, non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. And what we're specifically cultivating here when we cultivate the metta is this non-hatred. Sayadaw, in his talk yesterday, really emphasized the importance of the fact that metta doesn't dwell on faults. As he said in his book that Aria quoted, the spirit of metta only sees the good side. It never dwells on faults. And as we've said in various ways already, the natural function of metta is to promote this kind of friendliness, to encourage an open-hearted welcoming towards ourselves and towards others. And the caveat here is really that it's not that we ignore faults or don't see them or push them away, but the operative word here is dwelling. We don't obsess about them. We recognize our own faults, the faults of others. And we don't sit there and think about it over and over and over again. So the spirit of metta is what undoes this tendency to obsess about faults. And some of us are temperamentally made so that we can't easily be peeled away from seeing the faults. Some of us tend to go there naturally. This is our habit. But really take heart, because if you're in this same boat, metta is the explicit antidote to fault finding, to obsessing about what we see as wrong, to dwelling there with any kind of negativity. In the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, metta is not listed as a separate mental factor, but is classified as adosa, not dosa. So this dosa is what gets purified. And as we've said in previous talks, the continual reinclination of the mind that we do in the metta practice is in fact a continual feeding of the metta at the expense of this dosa. I could give a whole talk about dosa because I kind of specialize in it, or have, you know. It's really a strong habit in this mind. But I just want to briefly mention, we think of this word in Pali, dosa, and we think ill will, which is, or anger. These are common translations. But dosa has many forms and many guises. There's what I think of as the anger family. So irritation, ill will, spite, frustration, aversion, disgust, resentment, bitterness, even it can go on. The anger family is the family of mind states that strikes out in response to a stimulus. Explicitly pushing it away. And all those variations are, you know, how we hold on to it, how long we hold on to it, what we do with it, the emotion associated with it. Then there's the fear family. And this is not immediately obvious, intuitively. But fear is also a pushing away. So fear, anxiety, nervousness, worry, angst, all the way to panic. You know, everything from the little niggle of habitual anxiety to full-on panic attack. And then there's grief, which is also a form of dosa. It's a pushing away of the experience of loss and a dwelling on that. So the metta purifies any of these forms of dosa. The Buddha offered the Metta Sutta as an explicit protection against fear. So if there is a lot of fear in the practice, in the life, then metta is a wonderful practice to undo that. But of course, what is also purified are not only these explicit dosa states, but the flip side of the coin, which are the states of craving that are often accompanied, or that often accompany dosa. So we don't want that, but we want that. So craving is often associated with dosa. They come often as a pair. So that verse of the Dhammapada that I opened the talk with is fulfilled as we do the metta practice. Cultivate the wholesome, refrain from the unwholesome, purify the mind. Feeding and starving. And this practice of feeding and starving really requires a kind of balance. Because it's the paradox of two things. And this is a wonderful paradox. It's the paradox of engaging in the practice. As Uriah was saying yesterday, we have to engage in this practice. We do something. And the metta that arises just by itself when we create the conditions for it to arise. Both are true. We don't create the metta. We're creating the causes and conditions for it to arise. All three of us, Ariya, Sayadaw, and I, have talked about this. Sayadaw yesterday spoke of causes and conditions. And we have to do something in order to do that. We have to make some effort. So here I want to segue into talking about effort, balanced effort. Effort in the practice is often confused with the energy we expend, and the energy which we can often misuse in order to try to create states or experiences. I'm sure you've all had that experience of the practice going into a nice balanced place, and metta is arising and it's happening by itself, and then conditions change. And then when the conditions change, we try so hard to get them back. We work really, really hard. Now, if I really focus, if I really concentrate on this phrase, yeah. And we use a lot of energy to do that. The result of misusing the energy that we have in this way can be exhaustion. So, you know, we get to 7:30 at night and it's like, forget it, I'm going to bed. I've had it. Or headaches. Focus, focus, focus. You know, really focusing very, very hard. And even you can see people's muscles tense up. But balanced effort is not that at all. Samma Vayama, which is the Pali for right effort, as a limb of the Noble Eightfold Path, is by definition nothing more than this feeding and starving. It's not about trying really hard. It's what we do with the energy that we exert. So Samavayama is fourfold. And think of it in terms of wholesome and unwholesome. So the first part is restraint, avoiding unwholesome states that haven't yet arisen. So, knowing perhaps if you indulge in chocolate, you're going to eat the whole thing. So staying away from it. Or finding a way to, you know, wrap it up in little bite-sized pieces and, you know. So restraining the mind and heart and the body from going to places where unwholesome mind states might arise. The second aspect of Samavayama is abandoning. So if an unwholesome mind state has arisen, this never happens, does it? Yeah, when it has arisen, abandoning it. And this amounts to not feeding by way of resistance or by way of indulgence and just putting it aside. And I love this word, abandoning. In English, it has the sense of, you know, you abandoned a dead car by the side of the road. You know, it doesn't work anymore. I'm out of here. Or you abandon the dead car, if you're responsible, in a junkyard. And that's, you know, that's quite a valuable thing, a car. But, you know, when you're done with it, you're done with it. We put it aside. So abandoning unwholesome mind states comes, especially when we see the consequences of them. We go, oh, later for this, I don't want to go there. And there comes a natural abandoning. But at first the mind is sticky. The mind wants to go to these mind states, it feels like. This mind, the one that this body comes with, loves dosa. It loves to chew on. And that mind state has a very strong gravitational field. But when you see the disharmony that comes, when you see the pain that comes inside, it's easier to say, oh, no, I don't think I want to go there. So there's restraint, there's abandoning. Then we switch to the wholesome side of the street. And there's developing or encouraging wholesome mind states that have not yet arisen. So, for example, strong and powerful metta. This is what you're doing here. You're developing. You're inclining the heart to it again and again and again, planting those seeds, developing the heart. And then after developing comes maintaining, or along with, actually, because we all have wholesome mind states that are arising. So maintaining the wholesome mind states that are present, feeding them. So this samavayama, this right effort, is not about trying or working really hard in the practice. Nor is it about having the practice go well or about having nice experiences. It's simply this constant and unwavering support of wholesome mind states and withdrawing our support from unwholesome ones. We've talked a lot about continuity. And this is kind of a shorthand for this whole fourfold right effort. It's actually one aspect of right effort, and it's essential. So the early texts mention five factors that support right effort, one of which is this continuity. The first is conviction, confidence in the teacher, in the teachings, specifically actually in the Buddha, that he woke up, he was a human being. If he could do this, so can I. That's what it boils down to. He wasn't a god or some celestial being. He was a human being that over lifetimes purified and perfected the heart. And we all come with the same things, mind and body. The Buddha had a mind and body, so do we. One of my first teachers, Manindra, used to say, the Buddha solved his problem, now you have to solve yours. And I really like that, because the Buddha noticed that, oh yeah, we suffer. And look what happened to him, and it can happen to us if we want to. So there's confidence, there's conviction as the first support. The second is to be free from illness and discomfort, endowed with good digestion, not too cold, not too hot, of moderate strength. I don't know about some of you, but I know myself, I have a visceral sense today of the importance of that one. When you're ill and all you can do is sleep, this is not supportive of the practice. When all you can do is stare at the ceiling or the toilet bowl, this is not conducive to, practice in the formal sense. It can be very good practice in the informal sense. But we don't have the energy. We don't have what it takes to really bring the mind again and again and again to the metta. The energy's not there. And free from discomfort. This is why we say in the metta practice in particular, find a posture that's comfortable and upright. And if there's strong physical pain, adjust your posture or find another way to sit. So there's faith, confidence, there's health. The third is neither being fraudulent or deceitful to the teacher, to friends on the path, to oneself. Having the kind of brutal honesty that can look at one's own mind and heart and acknowledge what's really there rather than what we wish were there. This practice, and it's so interesting because you would not think on the surface that the metta practice would require this, but this metta practice really requires this honesty. And in fact, in the Metta Sutta, in the very beginning, those verses that we chant, the Pali is ujucha, sujucha. He is straight, very straight. And straightness in Pali has the same kind of sense as in English, meaning brutally honest with himself and with others. When we're honest with ourselves, we can see unwholesome mind states clearly, and we don't pretend we're full of wholesome mind states. And often what happens when people come in for interviews, and I don't know why this is, I don't think it's dishonesty on purpose, because people that come to a retreat like this, you're not dishonest people. But people often say, oh, the practice is going really well. That's it. And you dig a little bit and you say, oh, well, is there thinking arising? Oh, yeah, a lot. Ah, are there any unwholesome states arising? Oh, yeah, a lot. No, but we gloss over what we don't want to see. Because who wants to see that stuff? Bottom line, of course, we don't want to admit to ourselves that we're full of dosa, fear, greed, resentment, or whatever state it might be, that's kind of driving the train. And we have an idea that a good yogi looks like a certain thing, and we kind of fit ourselves in that box. But it doesn't work in the end. It can't. That's just delusion. And it's what stops the practice in its tracks. So I love it when somebody comes in and says, oh my goodness, today my mind has been all over the place. And then I know what I'm dealing with. And I know what they're dealing with. And they know what they're dealing with. And I know that. So, honesty. Confidence, health, honesty. And here's where we finally get to that continuity. He keeps his energy aroused for abandoning unskillful mental qualities and taking on skillful mental qualities. He is steadfast, solid in his effort, not shirking his duties with regard to skillful mental qualities. The steadfastness that is this continuity. No matter what's arising, we just patiently keep bringing the mind back. Faith, health, honesty, steadfastness. And the final quality that supports right effort is discernment. Understanding the process and knowing what is flawed and what is not. And being heedful of that. I love this word heedfulness, and it's a word that comes again and again in the texts. In Pali, it's apamada. And in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says heedfulness is the way to the deathless. Heedlessness is the way to death. So, being careful. In a really the word just escaped me. But being careful in a continuous and gentle way. Knowing what unwholesome mind states are. Knowing what unwholesome mind states are. Knowing the difference between the wholesome and the unwholesome. And being heedful of where the mind is going around this so that we don't follow them. If they're unwholesome, or we feed them if they're wholesome. So these are the five factors for right effort, that support right effort. And in the metta practice itself, it's very easy to see how each moment of cultivating metta fulfills right effort. This restraint, abandoning, developing, and maintaining. Very practically, you see it every day, many, many times. So we eat enough to support the body, but moderately. So there's wakefulness rather than sloth and torpor. This is restraint. We don't distract ourselves by getting too busy with, you know, cleaning our kuti or washing our clothes more than we need to, or, you know, I have a mind that likes to take toothbrushes into corners, you know, and it's like, that's a waste of time here. You don't have to do that. So we don't distract ourselves unnecessarily by unimportant tasks, but focus on the practice. This is restraint also. And then when working with the hindrances, we set them aside. We don't feed them in any way, by way of resistance or indulgence, as I was talking about the other day. That's abandoning. And we constantly come back to the phrase, to the object of our metta practice, and connect as much as we can. Just that's the way we do the practice. That's, of course, developing. And when the metta is aroused, we don't get complacent and stop the practice, kind of indulging in the niceness of it and trying to recreate it again and again. We just keep going with the metta, and that's maintaining that wholesome mind state. So, day before yesterday, Ariya mentioned sampajanya, and I want to pick up that thread a little bit here, because clear comprehension is closely related to right effort. And one variety of clear comprehension that I want to speak about is, there are four kinds. I don't want to talk about all four, but one in particular that I want to talk about is what in Pali is called Gochara Sampajanya. In English it's translated as clear comprehension of the domain. What does that mean? This is the awareness that keeps us from straying outside of our appropriate meditative domain, no matter what we are doing or what the posture is. The word gotra in Pali also means pasture, a place to put cows where cattle roam. And, you know, if you have a dairy farm, the cows have a particular pasture they're supposed to be in. And that's their gotra. And by extension, our pasture here is this cultivation of metta. This is what safeguards the meditation while we go through all the activities of the day. We're continually noticing with that discernment that I just talked about where the mind wants to stray off, get distracted, indulge in unwholesome mind states, just zone out. In our yogi job, in our daily activities, when we're taking care of the body, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, we notice if we've strayed or not. This is what results in continuity through the day. And the right effort that is the feeding and starving of wholesome and unwholesome mind states absolutely requires this gotra, sampajanya. Because knowing when we've strayed into the pasture of greed, into the pasture of hatred, dosa, into the pasture of delusion, is what allows us to then stop and pick up the practice again. To go back into our appropriate pasture. So having this gentle vigilance to know where is the mind going? And if we get spin so that we're spinning out on stories, something to do with our life out there, or the process, or our pet hindrance, or what we want, what we, you know, what we're craving, what we don't like, what the other yogi next to us in the dining room is doing, and how wrong that is. When we notice we're doing that, simply taking that aspect of right effort that is abandoning. Oh, I'm following that dosa thought. Later, and going back to cultivating loving kindness. At first in the practice, this can take a little energy, a little effort, because the mind wants to wander. The habits of the unpurified mind is to go wherever it wants, unhindered. And we all know that, you know, you can get on the train of thought and end up within three thoughts in some really suffering place. So this wandering around, following the mind wherever it wants to go, does not lead to the end of suffering. So in spite of that, we do it. And there are lots of reasons for that. But the reasons don't matter. What matters is that we know we've wandered. Come back. Open the gate to the pasture and put the cows back in. And it's really a light energy with no force. And it really helps to bring in a sense of humor about habits of mind that we all come packaged with, because we have these habits of mind. There's nothing we can do about our conditioning. It's there. It happened. Now what? You know? And there's some wonderful verses. I don't have the book with me. I wish I did because I could quote from it. But the first Buddhist monks and nuns. And the nuns in particular, there's some very funny verses where the nun is minding her own business. She's out in the forest meditating. And Mara comes by. And Mara is, in Buddhist cosmology, the being who wants to get people astray, wants them to go out of their gotra into something unwholesome, wants to block the practice. And so the nun is sitting there and Mara says something like, oh, you're so beautiful. Why are you sitting here in the forest dressed in those crummy old clothes? You could be making $1 million in the city. And the nun goes, this must be the voice of Mara. Mara, you're finished. You know, with a lot of lightness. And I love these verses because Mara is a metaphor for our habits. And even these awakened beings still had these habitual thoughts. But with right effort, they knew what to do with them. Oh boy, having the discernment to know that's an unwholesome, useless thought. I'm not going to follow that. So in the practice, often these thoughts come. It's, you know, the way the mind works. And not to resist that, but to kind of look at it and go, oh, thank you for sharing, later. And to bring some lightness into this, because it's not that serious. It's just a thought. And so bringing that sense of humor and that lightness to bringing the mind back. And also what's very helpful here is to just recall that this is conditioning that happened. We can't do anything about it. It's not personal. It's not a personal failing. It's just the way things are. Now what? And then remembering right effort. Oh, starve that one. I don't want to go there. Long before I ordained, when I still had a stable, normal life, I had a border collie. And these dogs are incredibly smart. And to train this dog, often I used a squeaky toy. Now, her mind would wander and she'd want to go off looking at something else. To get her attention, I'd get a squeaky toy and use this really stupid high voice. And I think about that when I'm training the mind, because if you use a squeaky toy in the mind rather than a bludgeon, you're going to get lots better results. So be nice to the mind. It can't help it. Oh, metta, yeah. You know, to have that lightness. And with this gentle awareness of wholesome and unwholesome mind states, and this gentle light reinclination, when we have a continuity of that, it's really possible to stay balanced in the practice, no matter what's arising, no matter what we're doing. And as the practice goes on, the momentum of this naturally builds. A number of you have mentioned in your interviews about this. Things start happening by themselves. Part of the reason for this is the function of right effort is to support concentration. So when concentration receives that support of right effort, and is balanced by this sampajanya, it can collect the mind and fix it on the object of our attention, on this metta. And it fixes it firmly there. And it's not something that we can create or construct. It just happens. And a number of you have mentioned how this, from one moment to the next, things can shift and the mind drops into this. And that's an description of what it feels like when the momentum builds. So strong metta momentum happens. At the very beginning of practice, it begins when we have these small moments of metta, and then the mind slips away. But these small moments of metta replace our habitual reactivity. And these moments condition more moments, and more, and more, and more. So it's basically a feedback loop. And at first it feels like nothing's happening. And at first can be a long time, actually. Yeah, it can be weeks. It feels like nothing's happening. And then it's like this exponential increase, that suddenly things fall into place. And the feedback works because of this spirit of metta that Saito was talking about. The spirit of metta doesn't dwell on faults. So we don't notice the negativity anymore. We know it's there, but we're not going to kind of get lost in it. So the more we see the goodness in ourselves and others, the more metta arises naturally. The more metta arises, the more we see the goodness. And then the more metta can arise. So you can see how it's this wonderful positive feedback loop. And so when this picks up, these habits of dosa and the other unwholesome mind states are at least temporarily banished. When metta is strong and powerful, dosa cannot coexist with it. It's impossible. They're opposites. And sometimes, as I said, sometimes this happens very suddenly. To fear in particular, boom, it's gone. Of course, it's not a linear process. We have these moments and then slide back again and again and again and again. That's okay, because if we have one single moment of this kind of metta where fear drops away, it makes an indelible impression on the psyche. We remember that. And we know for the first time that there is a reliable inner refuge that somehow we can access. We're capable of accessing that. That's where the confidence begins to build. Oh, I can do this. And yeah, okay, maybe then we slip back because then we start trying to recreate it. But we know, if I just keep creating the conditions for the metta to arise, I can access that. And knowing that we can develop the skills in our meditation to access this inner refuge is such an incredible gift. It's really for most of us what keeps the practice going. We see, oh, yeah, this is where this is going. And I'm not there yet, but if I just keep applying right effort and sampajanya, it'll happen. And we relax into the process. We're not so driven to be free of all suffering. We know that it will happen. We just keep ourselves pointed in the right direction. And we'll get there. So I want to close today with some Dhammapada verses that in the actual Dhammapada don't rest next to each other, but they make a nice pairing. Those who build canals channel the flow of water. Arrowsmiths make arrows. Woodworkers craft wood. The wise tame themselves. The wise, being fully alive, rejoice in heedfulness and abide delighting in this ability. The awakened ones, firm in their resolve, vigorously apply themselves and know freedom from all limitation, which is liberation, true security. May it be so for all of us. Thank you for your kind attention, and may you all be well.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.